Well, I was working at the University of Michigan in the Institute for Social Research, which, on a project that was run by James Morgan to study the causes and nature of poverty in this country. And Guy Orchert was one of the members of our advisory committee, which met once or twice a year to react to the kinds of research materials we were producing. And it was because of his presence on that committee that I first learned about the University of Wisconsin and the fact that Orchert was trying to build up a simulation model of the United States. And so we had some discussions about the possibilities of having me come here, and I visited in the spring of 1960, I guess, and gave a seminar that was jointly sponsored by Harold Groves and Bob Lampman for their public finance students on the kinds of materials on the distribution of income we were generating from this study. So I was very excited by the prospect of dealing with computer models, trying to incorporate the state of knowledge into simulation form, and building up, as it were, a library of materials that could be tapped to bring together information from rather diverse parts of the economic and sociological discipline to tell us something about how people behave. And I guess I was perhaps more receptive than most people to this sort of eclectic approach to research, because the Institute for Social Research at Michigan was not affiliated with a particular discipline, and there were groups of social psychologists and economists and political scientists who had a good deal of interaction over the design of survey and the collection of data by personal interview.
Hold on. So you came here as a, assistant professor?
I came as an assistant professor, mm-hmm. and it was a departmental appointment, and other than the fact that Guy Orchert represented to me that they were trying to recruit a number of assistant professors, and they had experienced a great growth in the introductory economics course and wanted to get more people to teach there, I don't know that he had a particular role in the departmental choice of me as opposed to other people who I might have been recruiting at that time.
But he was...
It was his interests that meant a lot to me in terms of coming to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Had the SSRI actually started when you came?
I believe so. The SSRI was already functioning. It had some kind of an advisory board when I first arrived. Now I've missed out on telling you something. Although I was hired in 1961, I didn't come to the university until 1962, and I spent the intervening year at the Treasury in Washington, D.C.
Another reason all of you economists seem to have spent ahead of a step in Washington before you came here.
Well, the...
At least the ones I've talked to. So
when I arrived in 1962, there was already an organization and some kind of an executive committee running the thing, and Guy had reorganized it. I guess it must have been either in 62.
Well, Summers was chairman in 1963.
Lampman was the chairman the year I was gone, the very first year that
of
I
SSRI.
Came.
Of SSRI?
No, of the department.
No, I mean of, I guess and I mean director. Ah, it said chairman, and I assumed it was, it, but it may have been in the department. He was chairman of the department then. No, that was later. He was in 1970, 68 to 70. No, he was director of the SSRI
that
in 63.
That could very well be.
What I'm curious about is that or maybe this should come after. I would like to find out how the centers operated, and what they exactly were. Were they just people deciding to meet in an office one day a week, or is there information on how they?
Well, I was director of the Household Center for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, shortly after I got here, whether it was the fall of 62 or the spring of 63, I don't know, but. Shortly after I got here, Guy reorganized the SSRI and allowed for these separate centers that were to operate somewhat autonomously on different areas that he saw as important building blocks for the simulation model.
Do you know why he decided to do that?
Well, what he really wanted to do was to get some kind of functional working groups, groups of people who had a lot of common research interests, who would direct their activities towards producing the kinds of computer programming that would be needed for the simulation models, and it seemed like quite a reasonable way to organize the expected research output.
Do you know how it had been organized before?
Well, before there had been fewer people, and the only organization there was this policy committee or advisory committee that included people from the business school and various other parts of the campus.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that that policy committee continued to exist after the centers were organized. In any case, the centers operated quite differently. The Center for Econometrics, which Arnold Zellner was involved with, proceeded to become largely Arnold and his graduate students, with relatively little participation from other people. The Center for Demography and Human Ecology kind of acquired a life of its own. I guess I don't remember exactly when Ed Borgata was involved with this and when what is his name?
Norman Ryder.
When I came, Ed Borgata, I think, was the head of it.
Hmm.
And somewhat later, Norman Ryder, I think, became the director.
Split off in 1964, and he was director at that time.
And the gist of it was that Borgata left before it split off.
Left?
Wisconsin.
Oh.
Completely, and went someplace else.
Did you know him?
Borgata?
Mm, very well.
Not well, no.
Hmm.
I mean, I met him, that sort of thing. And I also met Ryder, and so, you know, I know what he looks like, but
yeah.
I don't know him.
No.
But in any case, it was clear that Ryder was not happy with the concept of the research mission of the SSRI, and I guess that's why they decided to split off. I never saw a really good reason why demographic research couldn't be contained within the SSRI, why it had to. I viewed the SSRI very much as in the same way that I viewed the Institute for Social Research at Michigan. It was a holding company for a variety of relatively independent centers, and that the centers could have several programs of different kinds of research. And the thing that really necessitated an overarching organization was a common interest in exploiting computer technology, exploiting modern data collection methods, and that certain kinds of technical people had to be there to support those things. But I think my view, which I think is also probably very close to Orchid's view, was not widely shared by people at the university.
Yeah.
And so the demography group split off, and I never...
But to begin with, they've taken SSRI funds, or isn't that the way to put it?
I know nothing about the funding arrangements.
Oh. What about you? I mean, you were on the economics faculty. Did you get part of your salary from SSRI? Is that the way it worked?
Orchid had some money, which he, for simulation modeling of the U.S., and to pursue the thing I mentioned earlier on, I probably in 1963 or maybe in 1963 was thrown into the position of running the household center, and I took that task reasonably seriously and tried to figure out a way in which the several pieces of research that were being done on household economic behavior could be translated into a set of results that would be consistent with creating a computer program to generate values for individual families of their housing purchases and their durable stocks and a variety of other kinds of behavior. And our group would meet probably at monthly intervals.
Are these faculty or graduate students or both?
It was a combination of faculty and graduate students. And what I saw as particularly important was having some kind of a common language for communicating about our findings, a need to establish, as it were, a dictionary of the variables that one would have to have values for in order to create a simulation module, and a dictionary of the products, and then to generate some consistency between what values we were generating and what values were available as input data. And so I tried to create a framework within which it would be easy for researchers who were proceeding in a decentralized sort of way to pursue their own individual substantive research to report their findings in a way that could be computerized. And Arthur Goldberger was quite supportive of this activity, and to the point that he came regularly to meetings and was sympathetic with the notion of having this kind of reporting framework. And a number of the graduate students who were supported by ORCID's grants and whose papers and theses were part of the early SSRI reprint series, people like Tang Hung Lee and Maulin Lee and Ed Greenberg. You can look through the list of reprints and I could check off some of these people. Also contributed pieces that fit in with this household behavior modeling. But there wasn't much interest on the part of the faculty that antedated ORCID. And I think in retrospect, although it wasn't at all clear at that time, in retrospect, Orchid was rather disappointed that Zellner didn't see as one of his tasks, to building up of a communication network with other colleagues that would lead to this sort of computer simulation. While I was working on trying to get some actual specifications for a model for the household, ORCA was working on trying to enhance the computer capacity in the campus and the capability for being actually able to run a simulation and put in place the sorts of population simulation that he had developed at Harvard.
Now, hold on. This I have the advantage over you of remembering what you said last time, which is in the tape index. You did say that, and one thing that occurs to me is whether how much he was, or you were, or other people were involved in the problems having to do with deciding what computer to use on campus and dealing with Mervyn Muller. There was a great deal going on in the 60s. It was a very painful, difficult problem.
Let me talk to that after a minute and straighten sort of the building of the simulation model out for you. In any case, ORCA paid attention to the population side of the simulation model and the necessary ancillary computer work and built up a programming staff. And actually, John Corbell also participated in this household model. And unfortunately, the only real product of the household modeling activity, other than the substantive papers that were published in journals, the product that I would point to as the only thing I could show as director was that I gave a paper at the first World Econometric Meeting in 1965 on a syntax for building up a computer simulation model. And it was not very well received. I don't know, in retrospect, I don't know whether it was a good paper or not, but already at that time there were people in the profession who were very jealous of the quantity of funding that Orcutt had, and other people were saying he was approaching the problem in a way that was basically not feasible. And so I don't know what date the Ford Foundation report is, whether 66. That's 66, yeah. But so you can see in 65 it was clear to me that a different kind of research strategy had to be followed, because we couldn't get enough senior people really to take the notion of building a simulation model seriously. And the junior people didn't understand enough about what was going on. You couldn't do it all with research assistants. So I think the year 65-66 was a very painful year for ORCID, and he also came to the end of his first round of funding. Now, in that process, I must have had some release time from ORCID's funds, but I couldn't tell you just how much it was. I also came on very early in the game, and this goes back to the fact that it was the Lampman Grove seminar that I participated with when I first came out to visit the campus. Groves was interested in problems of taxation and equity of taxation, and indeed since the late 30s, when would that have been? I can't date it exactly, but he and some of his graduate students had been involved in a project in which they studied tax returns of people in the state of Wisconsin. And whether that took place in the late 40s or just post-World War II, I don't know. So, this work was published actually by the National Bureau, this early work of Groves, in a book that Groves wrote about income tax averaging, and another book by Tom Atkinson on the portfolios of Wisconsin taxpayers. So there had been a long time interest in using the tax data as a source, basic data source. And I was kind of inclined towards data collection anyway from my Michigan experience. Mm-hmm. And so when Groves and Roger Miller said they'd like some more help in working with the data collection, I was very ready to do that, and I rapidly got deeply involved in that tax data file, and most of my research support came from that funding, which was, to begin with, a little bit of Brookings funding, and then later on National Science Foundation funding, and some Social Security funding, and Roger Miller and I raised a lot of that money. So the extent to which I got funds from ORCID's project was rather small.
I see. That may... one of the things you said in last time was that to the extent that ORCID was putting his grant money into the SSRI, he was seen as building an empire. And what I'm curious about is what else would he have spent it on, if not on the SSRI? And what should his strategy have been that would have satisfied his critics?
I don't know. I think the university is basically very protective of the notion that there's academic freedom and the faculty can work on projects that they choose because they're interested in them, and that every faculty member is a peer with every other faculty member. And that makes it difficult to work on large research undertakings where you need to have a critical mass of 8 or 10 people to get the job done. And I don't think it's just ORCID who has had difficulties getting a critical mass of people to pay attention to a problem long enough to see it through to the end. Now, in the case of the physicists, where they sort of have to organize themselves around a very expensive tool like a synchrotron or an accelerator, maybe it's a little easier to get the problem solved than the case of the social sciences, where the tools are not always so clear.
Mm-hmm.
And
but he had money, wasn't it for SSRI, or could it have been for something else?
Well, he received money in order to build simulation models of the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't know exactly how that money was spent, and I am sure that in one way or another there were people like myself who received some encouragement in their research work because they had semesters of support from that project. And ORCID's hope, of course, was that the result would be some tangible product that could be fed into this modeling activity. Now, I think none of us realized, and this is often the case in research, none of us realized how much effort was really going to be required to get the job done. Mm-hmm. And also how extraordinarily difficult it is to manage a large computer enterprise. That we had that experience with the Groves-David Miller project, that we started on something in Groves had started on it in 1962 before I ever got here. I was very quickly involved, I think actually even in the fall of 62. And they were working on a data collection problem which the federal government didn't successfully solve until 1973.
Mm.
So that's 11 years.
Yeah.
Now, it isn't that the federal government wasn't trying, because at the time that this team was here at Wisconsin, the Social Security Administration did have a project and under the direction of Joseph Steinberg, at which they were attempting a link-up between Social Security records and tax records. And for one reason or another, I've never understood why, we were able to achieve this link-up and to work through the problem and get it solved by ...1965, when the efforts that the federal government put into it really didn't produce pay dirt until Fritz Scheuern took over the project and he produced a large data file with similar characteristics for the early 70s that became usable in the mid and late 70s.
And so they didn't make use of what you would discovered, learned.
No, I mean, that's right.
Yeah. That was part of SSRI, that you were doing that under
Well, I mean, that you see, SSRI had these two functions. It had the research grant that ORCID received to work on simulation models.
Mm.
It also served as an avenue for transmitting other research grants, just like the Poverty Institute
yeah.
does now, or any one of another number of other institutes around the university. And so the money under which I was funded was administered through the SSRI. And that was convenient because they had an administrator who understood all the mechanical things that had to do with research funding and a secretarial pool that didn't impose on department resources and a variety of other things. It was just a useful thing to do
yeah.
then. It's still a useful thing to do now, to have some facilities within the university that are specialized for research needs.
Yeah. Were you aware of the fact that there was deficits in SSRI, and this was a problem when the university administration was talking about it? And, this was.
Well, we created one on this David Miller project.
You did.
Yes, it was a great embarrassment to me. But what happened is we ran out of funds. And I would guess that must have been in 1966 or 67.
Mm.
And well, I've forgotten how many thousands were involved, but it was something on the order of a year of my salary, I think.
How did you do that?
Well, the university's accounting system was totally incompetent. In other words,
Reuben Lorenz and
the university had approximately a 6 to 8 week lag between the time when resources were actually committed and expended and the time when the PI on a research project received notification that the resources have been used up.
Oh. Is that and still the case, or is it just
a
bug at the beginning?
Oh, no. I mean, the university accounting system has been immeasurably improved
since
then.
Mm.
And they did not really have control of a number of resources, including use of the computer. And the SSRI had a revolving account, which is something they now also have control of, but didn't at that time, where it was possible to obligate funds without necessarily having a positive source of payment for those funds. That can't
mm.
be done any longer.
Mm.
So these problems have been solved.
I see.
But I think it's not fair to charge the SSRI with duplicity or malevolence. It was basically that the university accounting system didn't work.
What he said was that there was a, this is 1968 actually, $131,000 deficit, and $100,000 of it had been created during the last year.
Yeah.
So that made.
Well, a lot of that had to do with control over computers and control over the programming shop that the SSRI created, which was inadequate. Well, I told you earlier, Orcutt supervised the development of a programming staff that could be of service to social science faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And they then set themselves up just the way the hospital pharmacy sets itself up as a service agency to various people who came in and wanted
people.
To have jobs done.
Mm-hmm.
And then in some cases there were cost overruns, and in other cases they project for whom they had done work, because of this accounting lag in the university, the person who had the money would find he didn't have it anymore.
Don't worry.
Okay, where are we now?
Well, you have such a short amount of time, evidently. What did you said 45 minutes you were had to tell us coming back. I really would very much like to know what you'd have to say about the computer, what computer they were getting in Mervyn Muller.
Orcutt was very much involved with computer architecture, and Mervyn Muller was obviously a good friend of his.
Because he's thought by some to have been a disaster on campus in regard to computers. That's why it's interesting.
And so the purchase of new hardware was an uneasy coalition between, as I understand it, the physicists and the rest of the university. And the physicists kept wanting bigger and bigger machines, and Orcutt was very interested in this because he wanted to have large memory.
He wanted
and
a bigger machine too.
Rapid processing to be able to deal with these things.
Mm.
But at the same time, the every time you got a new machine, it meant some very difficult problems of moving the historic programs from one computer to another.
Were you aware? I mean, the CDC 3600 was. They got that in 1963, and then there was a, mm-hmm. there was a question of whether to get a UNIVAC or an IBM. Were you?
I was not involved in the politics of any of that.
Yeah.
I personally felt that really up until the Pinkerton era at MACC, that the computing center was extraordinarily closed-minded to the needs of large data users like myself.
Hmm.
And we, through this tax project, we ended up working with the business school computer, which was an IBM machine. We worked with the Burroughs machine. We worked with the CDC machines. And we worked with the UNIVAC machines. And there were many, many cases where the computing center just did not have adequate arrangements for handling large quantities of data, and where we had incredible aggravations as a consequence.
What was it? I mean, that would be its main function, you'd think.
No, they were basically oriented to the needs of large computational problems. People who had a small series of observations along a track, which is what might come out of a physicist's laboratory, and then compute on that for several hours to decide what kinds of particles are hit each other. Or the chemists do the same kind of thing. Whereas in the social sciences, we have this problem that we have current population survey records or tax records where there would at most be 200 to 500 variables for an observation, and then we'd have a long string of observation in the current population survey that's now 65,000 households per observation. And so you need a different architecture for your computer, and you need to be sensitive to the fact that very simple things like moving one word from one place to another, or translating it from one form of computer representation to another, are extremely costly when they're done several million times, and that therefore you have to put energy into managing different kinds of things for the social scientists than managing things for the physicists. And the latest sort of manifestation of that tension was a debate between the computer center and various people on the campus about whether we should have the so-called SAS statistical system. And
when was that debate?
That debate was in the late 70s. And the debate really hinged about whether there would be some kind of a computerized link between the equipment that people were accustomed to dealing with and the administrative computer on campus. So.
And who won?
Well, I couldn't say that it was a question of winning or losing. That was one of the reasons why there was always a problem, that basically it had to do with the question of what do you do first. And in the 60s, in an environment where you were changing the big machine very often, and even changed manufacturers, the thing that obviously had to be done first was to make sure that you could do anything at all on the computer, and sort of worrying about specialized needs of social sciences came down the list. And that's why the programming capabilities of SSRI were advantageous, because people in SSRI developed algorithms that do things that are still a very important part of the Mac capabilities. They designed something that is the primary processor for handling large files now. I think it was actually programmed at MACC. They designed and built up the first elements of the tabulating program and regression programs that are now part of the university's statistical processor, and so on. So these things were done over here, they sort of debugged and then transferred to Mac and became part of the Mac capabilities.
You said that Mervyn Muller was a friend of Orca, so that they were friends.
I think so. They both went to the World Bank about the same time.
And yet Muller was brought here, as you say, by the physicist, and wasn't really paying attention to what the social science. Or wasn't it he? Was it just a general policy in the computer?
I can't really say. That is, computation is a difficult field, and our understanding of it has developed very significantly over the last 15 years. And the computer center, I think, had some real problems of management, of taking on large tasks and then not being able to complete them. It's hard to say whether that was a worse problem here than some other places. It certainly was worse than at Michigan. I had experience with the Michigan system, and the people who ran the computer shop in Michigan were themselves computer scientists and very alert as to how to exploit hardware as it came along.
Was that the difference then?
In this university, I really can't say why the program development proceeded so slowly, but a lot of things that had part of it proceeded slowly because they worked with machines that were not standard. I mean, IBM was considered the standard machine, and there were a lot of people working on this. So if you bought an IBM machine, then you could automatically take over some results from other places. Here, those things had to be solved from scratch.
Mm.
And part of it surely was a problem that had to do with the difficulties of buying a computer machine. When they first got the UNIVAC machine would write data tapes that it could not read. I mean, that obviously was a big boo-boo on somebody's part.
Yeah.
And whether that was the manufacturer's boo-boo or whether it was the purchasing committee's boo-boo not detecting this problem, I don't know. But, I mean, that's where you got your frustrations with the thing. You then discovered that the UNIVAC machine tapes had to be translated from the form of tapes that were used by every other part of the industry. So then you had to put a big effort in. So those sorts of things caused difficulties. And now we're at a point where we have some fairly standard ways of dealing with those problems. We don't think about them very much anymore. But even so, there does remain a difference in sort of the kinds of needs of social sciences and physical sciences.
The social science building is getting a computer, I understand. I mean, it's going to have its own, what is it here? Jean Smolensky was talking about it.
Well, the data, the demography people have a computer.
Mm-hmm, I know that. But this was something else.
And Hal Winsborough is running a project through the census that has a computer in Kansas.
And yeah, that's right, that's the one.
And that computer will come as a gift to the social science departments at some point. And at that point we have to figure out what to do with it.
Are you in favor of it? Of its coming? Or isn't that the right question? I gather from the way Jean Smolensky spoke that he thought it was...
I think the problem is always to know how to best use your resources, and it isn't clear to me that more computer capacity is what we need.
Mm.
It is clear to me that we're going to have to change the way we sell computer time on this campus, because at the present time the Mac facility is charging a relatively high price for its services, and there are a lot of people who think they can do better by using other machines. And so the Academic Computing Committee sits there and approves the purchase of lots of other computers. Mm. Well, that can't go on forever.
What that would lead to.
And then what it will lead to is a lot of people with their own computers who don't understand very well how to take advantage of them. So you still haven't solved the problem, because they will be looking for expert help. And so I believe the MACC, as I say, is now being managed with a university-wide interest and much more sympathetic to needs of the social sciences. And I worked very successfully with them while I was director of the Data and Computation Center downstairs a few years ago. And so I think the best mode of operation is one that involves some kind of liaison between specific groups of computer users and the knowledge that experts at MACC have about the hardware.
Mm.
So one thing that might happen to this Kansas computer is that it gets given to MACC with the understanding that people in the social sciences can use it at very low cost, and that would seem to make a lot of sense.
Well, let's get back to the SSRI. There was a... Apparently it was thought to have been badly managed, to put it in the passive. Agner was made director in 1965, or 66,
yes.
Maybe?
Agner.
He's not here now.
No. Before that, Dick Day took over from Guy Orchard.
Well, Dick Day was appointed by Leon Epstein when he was dean in 1968. And was Dick Day also director earlier?
Oh, let's see. Well, I would have thought that Orchard was the director until he left. Was that 1966?
It probably was.
That's not quite true. That is, there was this chairman role.
Yes.
But I think in terms of the money, research money that was managed for producing a simulation model, Orchard was the principal investigator.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Orchard left, and I would have thought that Dick Day was the next chairman after him, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, Dick Day was... I'm just trying to find the memo. Anyway, he's 1968, 69. And
Agner was chairman just before I was.
Yeah, and is it... Well, he must have been chairman earlier, too, then. Anyway, there's a reference to his having to look around for the bodies, which I don't seem to be able to find at the moment. I mean, what would have been meant by that? This is a memo that Atwell wrote to Lawrence when he was talking about the management.
I think you should keep a distinction in mind that there was the SSRI as a research institute and a vehicle for disseminating information that was produced by associated faculty. And I think that functioned very well in terms of assisting faculties and getting manuscripts to publication stage and staging the reprint series and whatnot. Then there was as I've called it, the pharmacy aspect of the SSRI, a subgroup of people who had a programming shop where they did contract work for various researchers having to do with statistical computation primarily. And the management problems were in that programming shop. And the management problems in the programming shop are problems that I think fall equally on the university and on the SSRI, because as I've suggested, the university had an inadequate system of accounting control over its computer resources. It had an inadequate system for charging back to projects for the services of this organization, and it had an inadequate arrangement for handling the revolving account through which the programming shop would hire people who would then regularly be paid in due course on this side, but the mechanism on this side that would recover the funds didn't work properly.
Yeah.
Now, in 1982, we know how to do that.
Yeah. Yes, and so much of this is due to inexperience.
And we don't get into trouble with that.
System.
And so the sort of the level of activity in that organization varied enormously. And one of the people who was in that organization at that time was Elton Wock. Elton Wock is now the general manager for the MACC. And I think you should put it to him, was the shop mismanaged? No, my impression is there were just some very serious deficiencies in being able to do things in a timely way in the university of the late 1960s that have been resolved.
Well, in 1968, Dick Day met with in Jerry Summers and Young and Epstein met and made some decisions about the SSRI, and reading this one's curious about them. One, they decide to go easy on starting new centers and to reestablish centers annually, and that the center director should be appointed by the dean. What were the reasons for these?
Well, Dick Day tried to, you know, get the phoenix out of the ashes. I mean, Orchid had left and he'd gone to the World Bank. He took all his resources with him, and it was clear that these centers didn't work the way Orchid had intended them to work. And Dick had his enemies on this campus, but I think he made a genuine effort to try and create a well-functioning research organization within the framework of SSRI. Some of those centers, like the Household Center, existed in name only. There were a few projects that were administered through SSRI and had the name Household Center on it, but it was basically just a classifying device for which file folder you would put certain kinds of things that people in the SSRI were doing. And I thought that was useful in terms of maintaining some distinction in the preprints and reprints between what came out of, you know, kind of assembling like things mm-hmm. together. But in fact, as I've indicated, by 1966, it was clear that the Household Center was not going to be able to put together a simulation model the way Orchid had imagined it would, and that idea was abandoned. So, come in!
Whoops.
Yeah, it'll be another 10 minutes or so, okay?
Okay. If you want, you can just give me a call.
I'll give you a call. That'll be great.
Okay.
So Dick had the very sensible idea that we ought to try to do away with some of the administrative paraphernalia and try to limit things to what were reasonable in terms of the intellectual substance. And so I think I can't recall that meeting in particular, but he certainly went to the deans. It was his initiative to go to the deans, and he went to the deans with the notion of, let's try and strip down the SSRI, the kind of structure that's really useful to the university. That was the notion.
Mm-hmm.
And so some centers that were not really functional were disbanded. Now, when I was director, which would have been in 1971. This sort of operation came to its ultimate conclusion, which is I was faced with a long list of people who were sort of nominally affiliated with the SSRI and a de facto group of people who actually used the services of the organization. And I said, this is ridiculous. We don't want to carry all this overhead around. And so I set up an arrangement for an annual membership subscription that would help defray the costs of the organization, and a system whereby people effectively exercised an annual option for whether they wanted to participate in the institute. And that's been the way things have been done since 1971. And the result of that immediately was to reduce the nominal size of the organization from, say, 60 people to 15,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't really change what was going on. And from a funding point of view, the way things are handled now is on a definitely proper basis, with people buying the research services that they need from the pool that's available within the organization. And
you mean on money
so
that they get
the group is basically a group that feel they have something in common in terms of research methods and the kinds of approaches to solving economic problems that involve quantitative and theoretical tools, and that's what keeps it together. And after this big debacle over the programming services running a large deficit,
mm-hmm.
the dean insisted that that be reorganized, and it was reorganized, and the residual of that first became a subunit of the Data and Computation Center. That was during Dick's regime, I think. And then all the contract programming services ultimately went over to MACC, and that was abandoned completely
mm-hmm.
In the early 70s sometime. And so now the Data and Computation Center, which Dick had set up, is a separate department. It's no longer part of SSRI, because the dean said if he was going to have anything to do with it, it should be independent. And the Data and Computation Center services some of the needs, computer-oriented needs and data-oriented needs of the social science faculty.
Mm-hmm. Why was Dick Day so, as you say, not entirely popular with everybody?
Well, Dick was very well-meaning, but he had some eccentric ideas, and he didn't always listen too carefully to what other people told him, and so I think some people felt he kind of went off on very strange tangents from time to time.
But the other
side of it was he had a lot of energy, and he applied his energy in a rather positive way on behalf of the university. He attempted to ferret out new forms of funding for SSRI, and he was instrumental in producing certain kinds of data extraction programs for general use within the university. So, I liked Dick very much, so my perception has always been that the people who badmouthed him didn't really have a very strong case.
Mm. Was he academically, was he on
very well thought of? Mm. There is this thing, he had some eccentric ideas in his research that other people didn't agree with, but nonetheless he certainly was doing research that was in many ways on a frontier of economic understanding, and I think nobody would deny that.
Mm-hmm.
And he supported a large group of graduate students
mm-hmm.
to work on things he was interested in.
I had a lot of questions written down here about in connection with ORCID's report, the Ford Foundation. I don't know. I guess this whole question of long-run unrestricted support, which he said was terribly important, was it really possible that they would have given, did they give organizations of this sort, other people, that kind of money, or did it have to do with him?
Oh, well, I don't recall Orchid's report.
Well, it's just that instead of getting $200 million.
I think Orchid was right in one regard, and that is, it is incredibly difficult to run a research enterprise if all the money you have is project-oriented. And within this university, there are a number of mechanisms that assure that we don't have that situation, that we can, in fact, make emergency appeals to the grad research committee for research funding, and we have a variety of other devices, like the Romnes professorships, that give people of outstanding quality some funds that are unrestricted in character. Now, the thing that was so marvelous about the Poverty Institute is that they had a fairly large volume of unrestricted funds.
Mm, that's true, yes.
And they could, in fact, use that as a base from which they would build a larger operation.
Yeah.
And I think if you're going to have a research institute of any stature, you have to have something close to that base of unrestricted funds, or you can't nail down the people you want at the point in time that you want them, and you can't sort of shift directions when the institute feels it's important to shift directions, instead of when some outsider feels it's important to shift directions. And sometimes that can be the difference between actually getting started on an important kind of research or not.
So actually they just basically didn't have faith in Orchid. To that's